Okay, let's... oh, wow, this is powerful, isn't it? Let's lower the volume a little bit. And... it's better now, Dad?
Yeah.
Can you hear all well at the back? Good, great. Okay, let's get back to our task. So last time, on Tuesday, we didn't quite finish with text classification. We had a few things, a few important things, actually, left over. And so what I'll do today is start with a brief wrap-up and point out what was left over. Okay, so what we've seen on Tuesday is a way to classify text. Okay? Of course, always, when we want to classify things, well, most times we want to be Bayesian, essentially, to use Bayes' theorem because it's an excellent way of incorporating prior knowledge. But given a document, there are some non-trivial questions that we have to answer first, okay? So document is text, is not immediately amenable to be represented and handled numerically. So what we've seen is two very simple models in which we can represent text and do computation with text, probabilistic computation. One is the Bernoulli document model, where we have a binary feature vector, and the elements indicate absence or presence of the corresponding word in the document. And the second model is the multinomial document model, where instead, in both cases, we have a vocabulary, which is a set of allowed words. All the others we ignore. And the generative model for the multinomial model is the toss of a dice with as many sides as the number of words in the vocabulary. Okay? So the an actual multinomial model representation of a text document corresponds of a vector with integer entries, and the integer entries correspond to how many times a certain word in the vocabulary appeared in that document. In both cases, one document is represented as a very high dimensional vector whose dimension is the number of words in the vocabulary. In general, that's very high for any practical application. Of course, in our examples, we only used three words because otherwise things become entirely impractical to be done at hand. Okay, so that's a little bit more details on the multinomial model, and that's how it works. It generates a document as a bag of words, and it's got a number of parameters. The parameters enter the likelihood, which are the probability of a certain word given a certain class. How can we do that? We need a training set, and the training set corresponds of a set of documents that are all in the class that have been labeled by a human expert, say. And therefore, we need to estimate from the training set these parameters, these likelihoods. It turns out that the best estimate, well, the maximum likelihood estimate, really, is the relative frequency of the word in all the documents. Okay, so this, we'd introduced this auxiliary variable, which was 1 or 0, depending on which class the document was. So this basically counts how many times the word happens in all documents classified as K, labeled as K, and this counts how many words there are in all documents labeled as K. That's why it's a relative frequency. But now there is a problem, and this is an important problem that we haven't touched on last time. And as the title of the slide gives away, the fact that sometimes we may have documents, not enough documents in our training set, essentially. So we may well have training sets which do never contain a certain word. Right? That's called the zero probability document. So if we have a certain set of training documents in our class, and if this set of documents is reasonably small, or if the vocabulary we're using is very large, then chances that there will be some words that do not appear in our documents. And if we train the model, as we said before, estimate these probabilities as relative frequencies, then we will end up with some probabilities being exactly zero. And why is that a problem? I see people shaking their heads. Yeah, great.
The words can still appear, we just haven't seen them yet. The words can still appear, we just haven't seen them yet.
Yes, that is true. But what consequence will it have? I mean, from a purely numerical point of view, really. Exactly. So we will believe that in that class, you will never see that word. So if you actually get a document which contains that word, you automatically say, this cannot possibly be in that class. Now, it could be even a worse problem that these words does not appear in any of our training documents in any class, in which case, you know, we would end up with a kind of a 0/0 numerical issue. Okay? But it is a problem. The main problem from the practical point of view is that you could get a document that fits extremely well with a class, except for one word that is a rare word that was never observed, and bang, we will never classify it correctly. And that is a problem that we've encountered before, of course. Do you remember the fish from outer space? There you go. That was the same problem. We had a fish that had a length that did not appear in our training set. So the way we trained the model, we said, all right, there's no way fish of 20 centimeters exist, so it cannot be a fish. We cannot deal with it. So that's exactly the same problem, okay? And it's, in this case, you know, one direction that we indicated in order to alleviate this problem was the naive Bayes direction, okay? So naive Bayes, why did we introduce naive Bayes? Why did we introduce naive Bayes? We had to, because I was telling you to do, that's the right answer, yes. But there is another answer, you know. Why did I tell you to introduce naive Bayes? So if I have data that is 10-dimensional, so how many samples do I need to estimate a distribution in 10 dimensions? That was the answer, right answer, too many. Whatever you want. I mean, unless you want to be of a coarseness that beggars belief, if you want any reasonable partitioning of your 10-dimensional space, you'll end up with something like 10 to the 10 points that you need to estimate probabilities reliably. And that was exactly the problem we had. So a lot of bins would have ended up with no points in it, and we wouldn't have been able to estimate. We would have estimated zero probabilities. So we said, OK, naive Bayes, that helps, because we always work in one dimension. Yeah, that is true. But there are situations where it may not work. And this is one of those situations where some dimensions are very, very rarely encountered. Okay, so there are some bins that remain empty, nevertheless. And that's the problem when we have a word that is very rare. Okay, or we have few documents in the training set. More about what you were saying before, okay? If a word does not occur in the training data, doesn't mean it cannot ever occur. So, the basic problem is to try to find a solution to this. And now, anyone, any idea? Well, okay, it's the title of the slide again, add one smoothing. Okay. So in old-fashioned way, if you get something that is zero, if you add one, it's not zero anymore, and that's great. Why adding one and not adding 0.05? That's an excellent question, actually. But for the time being, since we're dealing essentially with counts, and we have a multinomial model, what we want to do in order to ensure that we never run into the zero probability problem is to add some pseudo counts. Okay? And the pseudo count that we'll add is 1. So basically, this is called the Laplace method, if you wish, or add one smoothing. Smoothing in the sense that basically, you know, if you go from 1 to 0, there is a big gap. But if you go from 1 to 10, from 9 to 10, there isn't such a big gap. So you're making things a little bit smoother. What we're going to do is simply adding one pseudo count. Okay. But of course, I mean, that may make an enormous difference. So we add one pseudo count for every single word. Okay, so we don't just add one pseudo count for the rare words, we add it for every single word. So we put one at the denominator, so the estimate, the smoothed estimate of the likelihood is going to be the number of times the word appears in all training documents class this, okay, plus one, divided by the total number of words in all training documents of class K, plus one per document in the vocabulary, so plus size of the vocabulary. Okay. So this seems to be, you know, the dumbest thing to do. And as a rule, in this course, I'm only going to teach you the dumbest thing to do. But you go a long way in life by doing the dumbest thing, which is really surprising. And as I said, that's the fact. It's often used in practice. You mean whenever, if you want something that is really a quick algorithm for text classification because you have to classify a billion emails as spam or non-spam, you really want something that the machine doesn't have to think about. Okay, doesn't have to spend computational time, and you know even a computer doesn't have to think a lot about adding one to everything. And of course, as I said, this is the dumbest thing. There are other things that you could do, but I'm not going to tell you about. But you're very welcome to attend one of our numerous courses in the third or fourth year, which will explain this. Okay, so just to wrap up the text classification business before we move into the continuous domain and we start looking at Gaussians, this is a table that compares the two models that we looked at. So the Bernoulli model and a multinomial model, okay? So the generative model is different, and they take the name from the underlying probability distribution. So Bernoulli draws 0, 1 entries from a Bernoulli distribution. Multinomial draws a word from a multinomial distribution. And of course, this impacts the document representation, okay? So we either have a binary vector, or we have a vector of integers, which represent the frequencies of given words in the document. Now, a major problem with Bernoulli is that if you have one word that appears 20 times, it just gets a 1 in its feature representation, okay? So it throws away a lot of information, and that is why it is probably best for short documents, okay, where the frequency of words doesn't make a lot of sense. So if you were, say, to classify text messages, maybe Bernoulli model wouldn't be a bad choice. But of course, if you have to classify text, I would advocate using multinomial because it can deal with longer documents because it takes into account word frequencies. Now, the dimension of a feature vector, again, Bernoulli is best with smaller vocabularies, while multinomial can account for longer vocabularies. One drawback that we looked at last week that you very promptly replied, of course, if we have an extremely common word, the Bernoulli model, we basically always put 1 there, okay? But the multinomial model will put its empirical frequency in the language, which for the word the is apparently 1 in 20. And Bernoulli, this, you know, you could argue whether it's a plus or a minus. Non-occurring words do affect the likelihood. So it matters what you say, but it also matters what you do not say for a Bernoulli model. And that obviously, you know, makes sense. However, of course, you know, you have one term per term in the vocabulary in your likelihood. So you have a product of many, many numbers that can become extremely small, give you underflow problems, and so on. Multinomial model, words that do not occur don't matter. So that's great. And now we are back on track. This is supposed to be lecture number 8. And we're going to talk about Gaussians. Now, I presume you probably have all heard about Gaussians, okay? Have you all heard about Gaussians? Yes. You can speak. You know, it's not a problem. You can answer or raise hands or something. Well, what's the motivation? I'll go a bit fast, otherwise we will end up not having time. Of course, the world we live in, is made of continuous variables. There are some things that are discrete, like words are discrete entities, and there is a finite space of words, but a lot of things are continuous. So we want to have probability distributions over continuous numbers. The example here is, for example, the waiting time between buses. Time is a clear continuous variable. There is, I mean, I think even quantum physicists wouldn't argue that time is a continuous variable. But obviously, once you move on to the continuous variables, then remember, the meaning of probability distribution means assignment of a probability to a state. So if you have a continuous state, you have an infinite number of possibilities. And if it is continuous, it's worse than infinite and countable, because essentially you can move a little bit and things should not really change. Okay, so intuitively, we always want to have a continuous function, and the states for a continuous space cannot be thought as individual points. They have to be thought as segments, intervals. Okay? So it doesn't really make sense. What is the probability that my wait for the bus would be 3 minutes, 38 seconds, 0.3 periodic? Because it's going to be zero. Okay? Partly because you don't have, I mean, there is a practical reason why these things do not make sense, because you have a coarseness in the measurement process. But also from a conceptual point of view, if you want the probability to be somewhat continuous, in the sense that the probability of having 3 minutes is similar to waiting 3.5 minutes, then this implies that every individual state will be assigned probability zero. So every individual point. So what makes sense is assigning a probability to intervals. And the first most obvious interval is the one that goes from minus infinity to somewhere. Okay? So instead of saying, what is the probability that I will wait exactly x minutes, I could say, what is the probability that I will wait less or equal to x minutes? Of course, that's the same thing as the probability that we wait less than x minutes. Okay? And then what we could write is, for example, if we had, we could write any function that we like, okay, in some sense. So suppose I have, what type of weighting does this correspond to? Okay, so let's draw a probability density function. Clear instructions here to clear the board for the next lecturer. Uh-huh. Also because there is no way of erasing things. Hmm? Oh, is there? At the far end. Fantastic. There. So what does that say? Okay? That F is defined as the probability that my weight, big X, is going to be smaller than X minutes. Okay? Well, I can plot it, of course. That is my P. Okay, this is my X. Well, it's telling me that, of course, I cannot wait less than zero. Okay? That doesn't make any sense. So it's got to be zero here. And it's a nice linear function of x between 0 and 30 minutes. And then it says that it's going to be 1. So what does this imply in terms of buses? Hmm? They do come at random. That is also an observation. Yeah. But clearly the council has established a system whereby they sense that if you've been waiting for almost 30 minutes, they send a bus. So you're guaranteed that at 30 minutes you will find your bus. Not the most likely of probability distributions. But the key thing, oops, is that, as you see, the probability now is not defined So now it makes sense to say, what is the probability that I will wait for 15 minutes at most? I can go to 15, go up here, and read it on the y-axis. Okay? That is well defined. It's not zero. That's the cumulative density function. OK, so in general, these are general properties of cumulative density functions that follow from the fundamental properties of probability. Okay? So of course, they tend to zero at minus infinity. Okay? So the probability has to an interval. You know, at minus infinity, there is no interval. When you go to infinity, they have to tend to 1, because the probability has to measure 1. Okay, so the event will take place. You just don't know when it will take place. And then the obvious thing is that the probability has to be increasing. Okay. So if there is a half probability that you will wait 15 minutes or less, then the probability that you will wait 16 minutes or less, it's got to be more than that, because it's got to account for the fact that the bus may arrive between 15 and 16 minutes. So there is still exactly the same probability up to 15 minutes, plus a little bit, which has to be positive. And as I said, you know, once you have defined cumulative density functions, if you want distribution functions, if you want probabilities associated with an interval, you just take differences. Okay, so the probability of the bus arriving between 15 and 16 minutes is the cumulative distribution estimated at 16 minus the cumulative distribution estimated at 15. And if you want a more complicated interval, so you want to estimate for whatever reasons, the probability that the bus will arrive either in this interval or in this interval, well, you take this minus this, and you take this minus this. Okay, so union corresponds to the AND logic, which corresponds to a plus. Now, the natural thing that we want to do is to then think about cumulative density functions, since they are something that increase, in terms of being the integral of a function. Okay? So what I'm saying here is that there is a constant probability of the bus arriving that in an infinitesimal interval. Okay? So that the probability of arriving between here and here is proportional to the width of the interval. So in that sense, it is the integral of a constant. Now, you may know a lot about these things, depending on what you did in mathematics at school and in the first year. But what we want to do is to define the derivative of the cumulative distribution function, and that defines something that is called the probability density function, which is a fundamental object, which we really care about, the probability density function. Again, caveat, little p at x is not the probability that you will wait x. That is always zero. But what it is proportional to, if you have a very small interval around little x, then the probability of falling in that very small interval is roughly p of little x times the amplitude of that little interval. Okay, that follows from the definition of derivatives. Okay, little p is the density, big P is the probability. Okay, and as I was saying, we just have a constant probability density function associated with our bus example. You can go from one to the other. As I was saying, the PDF is the derivative of the probability, or the cumulative probability. The cumulative probability, of course, is the integral of the PDF. Okay, and you can be, if you plot the cumulative density function, if you plot the PDF, the probability density function, you can work out what is the probability by computing areas under a curve, or volumes under a curve, if you're in higher dimensions. And now comes the star of the show. You're going to hear about Gaussians a lot, not just this year, next year as well, in the fourth year as well. If you do an MInf, you'll probably get to hear about them in the fifth year as well. If you then go and work in machine learning, you'll hear about them every day of your life. And that's great, you know, they're a really nice thing. Okay. The model we had for the bus was a very unlikely situation. You had this model where, you know, there was a sensor at the bus stop, and if it sensed that you had waited for 29 minutes and a half, a bus would come and pick you up. The council hasn't implemented that yet. So we need probability densities that are more reasonable. Okay? And the Gaussian is one of these classes. And it's more reasonable for some really deep question, deep reasons, which we'll look at. But basically, intuitively, a Gaussian tells you that there is a certain well-defined value around which most of your experiments will result. And the results will be symmetrical with respect to this mean value, roughly, because the bell-shaped curve is symmetrical. The important property is that the so-called tails of the distribution, so how it looks when you go far from the mean, fall down very steeply in the Gaussian. So the things decay very fast. There is very little probability of being very far from the mean. If you have a scalar variable, then the Gaussian distribution is this negative squared exponential. This is the probability density function, okay? This is the PDF. And as you will see, there are two parameters here. Mu, which is the mean. Whereabouts is the bell-centered. Sigma squared is called the variance. And it's where, how spread out it is. Or rather, it's the square of how spread out. Pleasing fact. Gaussians all look the same. The only way you can make them look different is by shifting them or by stretching them. And the standard Gaussian, which has got mean 0 and variance 1, looks like this. Incidentally, the square root of the variance, sigma, is called the standard deviation. Okay? This is Mr. Carl Friedrich Gauss. This banknote doesn't exist anymore, as you will know. And here is the little Gaussian. But he's well known for a lot of other things, like fundamental theorem of algebra and so on. He was a really clever guy. Now, as I said, basically, if you plot several Gaussians, one on top of the other, and vary the variance parameter, you will see that when you increase the variance parameter, the peak lowers down. But it spreads out. Of course, the integral has to be 1 because it's a probability density function. So if you make it more spread, you have to lower it. There is no way out of that. Now, as I said, these are some properties of the Gaussian. They tend to be a reasonable model for variables that are quite clustered around their mean value, that are symmetrical, and that they really fall down quickly from the mean. So that it's very unlikely to find something. And this is an explanation. So the standard deviation, which is a square root of sigma squared, so it's sigma, about 68% of all the probability mass is between minus sigma and plus sigma. Okay? But what is remarkable is that only about 0.2% of the probability mass is between is outside of 3 sigma, bigger than 3 sigma, and smaller than minus 3 sigma. So it falls down really quickly. So whenever you find something, you know, you estimate a distribution as a Gaussian, let's say, then you get a new point that is 10 standard deviations from the mean, that is not a Gaussian. You can be pretty sure that that's not going to be a Gaussian. Or that's not an admissible point. There has been something very wrong with the way you've recorded it. Now comes the deep reason why Gaussians are important, okay? And this is actually really a cool thing. I mean, an extremely cool thing. And that's why they're called Gaussian, because Gauss proved this. It's not just that, you know, I come up with a PDF and they call it the Sanguinetian distribution. It has to have some fundamental thing, okay? And the fundamental thing is that if you take any random variables, okay, they have to be independently drawn. So you have to have a device that shoots out random numbers. Okay? And that could be really anything. You know, it could be decay or radioactive particles whatsoever. You measure the time that they take to decay. As long as they're independent, these measurements that you get, then if you sum them, the distribution of the sum tends to be a Gaussian. Or rather, the distribution of the mean, you can rephrase it because the mean is 1 over the total number times the sum, tends to be Gaussian. And this is called the central limit theorem, which is a really, really deep result. It's a really non-trivial fact.
And they have to be distributed the same distribution, those random variables.
They have to come all from the same distribution. There are weaker forms, but this is the standard form. They have to come all from the same distribution. So say you're measuring decay times of radioactive particles all from the same nuclear reactor. But you're measuring 100,000 of them, and you take the average of these half-lives, or these decay times, that's going to be Gaussian. And but not only, you know, continuous variables. You flip a coin, flip it 100 times. That's a good exercise, particularly if you've got time in your hands. And flip it 100 times and plot, you know, the distribution. So flip it 100 times 10 times. And then take the mean, give it 0 if it is tails, 1 if it is heads. Take the mean of these 10 and plot it. And it will be very closely approximated. If you don't have that much time, use MATLAB, generate a bunch of binary random variables and verify it. It's really instructive. So, you know, binary random variables, the state space is completely different. It's nothing to do with continuous. Tends to a Gaussian. Pretty much for the same reason, there are a lot of probability distributions that are well approximated with the Gaussian in the limit. So if you have a binomial distribution, okay, which is closely related to the multinomial, is in fact a multinomial where the vocabulary is of size 2, and it's the distribution of tosses of coins, essentially. A two-sided dice is called the coin. If you do a lot of tosses, you get that that distribution tends to be well approximated with a Gaussian. If you have a Poisson distribution, which you may or may not know what it is, tends to a Gaussian. Gamma distribution tends to a Gaussian when the mean is quite high, and so on and so forth. Okay? And I do concur with the statement that the Wikipedia entry will give you a lot more information. It's actually quite informative. Okay. So I hope I've given you the spiel about why Gaussians are great and why it's great to be in machine learning, because you hear about them every day in your life. And but what do we do with Gaussians, okay? How do we estimate them? So that's the usual problem, okay? We start with a model. So far we've seen multinomial model, for example. We've seen empirical model for fish and so on. We have to estimate them somehow to fit them to the data. Gaussian is yet another model for continuous variables, okay? It's got two parameters. We need to learn them from the data. And the way you do it is by something called maximum likelihood, which spits out this result. Okay? So these are called the empirical mean, and they're also closely related to the meaning of these words. Okay? So the mean, or the sample mean, is given by taking all the measurements that you have, or the numbers, or the inputs, summing them and dividing them by the number, by how many there are. And the variance is essentially given by the square deviation from the mean, okay? The expectation of the square deviation from the mean. So these, you can take them as formulae for the time being, but they come out, or there are very good reasons for using these formulae. Obviously, what we would like to do is to use Gaussians in pattern classification, okay? For example, if we have, let's assume that now these are game fish, and we have the S class are the female fish, the T class are the male fish. Now we have plenty of values of length of fish that we've not observed, but if we use Gaussians, that will not be a problem, as long as we can estimate the two parameters for each of the classes. To estimate two parameters, you generally need at least two data points. As a rule of thumb, you need a lot more to be any certain. So how do we do that? Well, it's very simple. We just take the average of all these. Of course, that gives me, if I sum them, it's 30. 22 plus 8 is another 30. 60 divided by 6 is 10. The variance is a slightly more intricate computation. Turns out to be 1. The T class has got mean 12, variance 4. That's just by using the formula that we had before. Okay? And what would they look like? Well, one is much tighter around the mean, 10, because it's got variance 1. The other one is centered at 12, but it's a lot broader. Incidentally, if I got a fish of length 5, how should I classify it? I would classify it as male, so as T. Why? Because there is information both in the mean and in the shape, so in the variance, the spread. So my data led me to believe that the female class, yes, on average is smaller, but it's got a much tighter variation, so that finding something that is 5 standard deviations away is extremely unlikely. While for the male class, there is more variability. In general, on average, they're bigger, but you can get very small ones as well. Okay? So this is kind of, you know, a little slide with some fundamental facts. Before we go any further, let's talk a little bit about extensions of the Gaussian distribution to higher dimensions. So we've seen that, you know, for fish we were working in one dimension, but if we were moving on to higher dimensions, we could quickly get into trouble. What happens with Gaussians? So the generalization of a one-dimensional Gaussians to a higher dimensional problem is so-called multivariate Gaussians. So often in statistics, the direction, so if you've got a variable with several dimensions, each dimension is called a covariate because they vary together. And therefore, a distribution that lives on a space which has more than one dimension, so it's got covariates, is called a multivariate distribution. And of course, it deals with vectors, and it has to deal with matrices as a result. Okay. These are called the mean vector, the covariance matrix, and they have some interesting meaning. Okay. Often, well, this should be a reasonably obvious thing, but what you can see from here is that the exponent of the PDF is a quadratic polynomial in the entries of X. Okay. And that's what is called a quadratic form. What is the meaning of these parameters, the mean and the variance, and the covariance? Well, the mean is simply the expectation of X. So what is the value that we expect? The covariance is the expectation of how much the random variable varies about its mean. And it is a matrix because it contains the information of how the ith entry of our vector, how it covaries with the jth entry. Okay, so the ijth entry of the matrix sigma would tell us pretty much if I move in the ith direction, in that direction off from the mean, does that predict to some extent in which direction the jth direction would move? So they covary, they are not independent, they're linked. It's got to be symmetric, of course, by the definition, you know, you can change, you can put transpose here, and everything gets, remains the same. An important fact is that it has to be what is called positive definite. Okay. Basically, if you don't have that, the total probability doesn't normalize to 1. Okay. So you have to have that property. And essentially, it tells me that it's shaped like a bell, as opposed to be shaped like a bowl, okay, which says the probability becomes bigger. Okay, so as I was saying, the sign of the covariance, well, not just the sign, the value of the covariance matrix between I and J tells me a lot about how linked the I-th coordinate and the J-th coordinate are. So for example, if the entry is positive, that means that if I increase, I make this difference positive, so I deviate from the mean in the jth direction, in the positive direction, then I would expect also the ith direction to deviate in the positive direction from the mean. Okay? Because the entries here are the expectation of these things, and if it is positive, it means that mostly they have the same sign. Could also be the opposite. It could be negative. That means that if I move in this direction, in the jth direction, on average I move in the opposite direction, in the ith direction. Okay? And that would, why is that? Because this matrix is given by the expectation, so basically the sample expectation, if you want to estimate it. And that would say that in most of the samples, I observe that if one is bigger than the mean, the other is smaller than the mean. So that the product here has a negative sign.
Sorry.
Yep.
What does it say if it's zero?
Right. What does it say? Nothing. Nothing. What does that mean?
Oh, no, that's what I'm asking. I mean, does it say anything?
Right. The question is, what happens if it is zero, the entry, the ijth entry of the covariance matrix? Okay. So if it is positive, it means that on average they tend to move in the same direction. If it is negative, then they tend to move in opposite direction. If it is zero, they're independent. Exactly. So there is, if you move in this direction, that doesn't tell you anything about where the ith direction is going to move. In fact, for a Gaussian, and only for a Gaussian, correlation and dependency are the same thing. So if two things are uncorrelated, they're also independent. The correlation is the scale version of the covariance. Okay? So basically, how much jointly they vary for deviations of unit norm. Okay? And it's given by taking the covariance matrix and divided by the square root of its entries, okay? Of the diagonal entries. Okay, so in this case, I'm taking my matrix sigma to have entries S11, SNN, this would be Sij, okay? So these diagonal entries basically tell me how much the ith direction is spread about its mean. These entries tell me how they co-vary. And if I normalize by how much each of the factors are spread about the mean, I get the scaled version of the covariance, which is called the correlation. Okay? The correlation is always between 0 and 1 for reasons that I'm not going to explain. But it's an important measure, essentially, of how things change, and it is independent of the magnitude of the change in each direction. Okay, so this is an example of a situation where you have some zeros in the covariance matrix. It's what is called a spherical Gaussian. And as you see, it's given by, in this case, we've set the mean to be zero for convenience. We set the covariance matrix to be the identity. If you do that, then the lines of equal probability, so which are given by the lines where the probability density function are constant, are circles. Okay? You may or you may never have seen these things, but you may recall that a quadratic form in the plane determines an elliptic curve. Okay? If the quadratic form is positive definite, which is this case, so if you want it to be bell-shaped, a probability density function, then there have to be ellipses. If I take the mean to be zero, and if I take this to be the identity, then the quadratic form basically says x squared plus y squared equals constant. That's my surface of constant probability. And that's a circle. I could also make an axis-aligned ellipse by having the variance in one direction bigger than in the other. Okay, so if I project this curve onto one plane, I get the probability density function for a single variable. Okay? This is obtained by marginalization, by summing. And then the probability density function, say, for the x1 variable would be a tight Gaussian with variance 1. For the x2 variable, it would be a broad Gaussian with variance 4. But still, there is no dependence, okay, between the two. That's because it's axis aligned. What happens if I do this? So it's a full covariance. Now I have a negative correlation, you see? If I move in this direction, the most likely value that corresponds to this value of the x is going to be found slightly lower. Okay? Does it make sense? So just imagine if you're cutting this figure along this line. Okay. Where is it going to find the highest value, so the most intense red color? Okay. It's going to be somewhere along the axis of this abscissa. So if I move this way, I'm more likely to have moved downwards. And that's why they're anti-correlated. Okay. That's how you read a plot like that. Okay, so this is a bit of summary for today's lecture. Now, we started talking about continuous random variables, so variables that take values in a continuous space, time or length of fish or whatever else. We looked at the univariate Gaussian PDF or one-dimensional Gaussian PDF, which is the exponential of a square with a minus sign in front of it. It's got two parameters, mean and variance. We can generalize it to higher dimensions, and that becomes a multivariate, which is parameterized by a mean vector and a covariance matrix. These parameters can be estimated from the data. And that's about it. We'll see more about Gaussians in the next few lectures. Okay?
Sure. So the mean is a vector, so it would be. The guy that got